You're listening to Access Minnesota. Now, here's Jim Dubois.
Our guest is Dr. Shmuel Lessig. He is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Minnesota. He is an expert on the psychology and biology of fear. Dr. Lessig, welcome to Access Minnesota.
Thank you for having me.
According to a poll from April of this past year, about 1 in 10 people globally said they were experiencing fear or anxiety about the impending end of the world scenario in 2012. As an expert on fear, what is your reaction to that?
My reaction to that is that we have a very low threshold for accepting threat information as real, because in our evolutionary past, the cost of missing a potential threat far exceeded the cost of a false alarm. So we're sort of better safe than sorry, and that's evolutionarily served our species because we have that disposition, or you might say individuals with the genetic makeup to respond to false alarms or to err on the side of false alarms rather than missing a threat were more successful at passing their genes. So we are very susceptible even to somewhat incredible threats.
Are there different kinds or levels of fear?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, one distinction that's made in the field is the distinction between fear and anxiety. Fear being an acute, short-lived response to an imminent danger, and anxiety being more long-lasting, free-floating, cue, non-specific. So that's one distinction, is fear versus anxiety, and there are different neural systems associated with each of those.
What goes on in our bodies when we experience fear?
So, you know, the classic example is walking in a forest, and we look down and we see a squiggly line, and we immediately think that squiggly line might be a snake, and so we become afraid. And with subsequent analysis of that squiggly line, we may determine that it's a stick and not be afraid. The neurobiology of that response is basically through the visual system, we see the squiggly line, and it very quickly activates an area of the brain called the thalamus, which is a sensory gateway to the brain, which then very quickly activates the amygdala, which is responsible for fear. But the thalamus is rather dumb and can't distinguish between fine sensory details. And so that squiggly line at that point is a very blurry, low-resolution image, but it still has access. That thalamus still has access to the amygdala, so we'll activate the amygdala very quickly. But the visual cortex, which is a higher order level of processing, will do a more sophisticated analysis, and if it determines that the squiggly line is a stick, it will project to the amygdala and turn it off. So you have a very quick, sort of quick and dirty response to threats that is very susceptible to false alarms, as I was talking about before. And then you have a slower, more refined processing path that goes through the cortex and makes its way to the amygdala and can regulate the amygdala based on the outcome of that higher order analysis.
Does fear manifest itself similarly across all animal species, or is there something unique about the way human fear manifests itself?
I think that the basic response is very, very similar. You have increased autonomic arousal. So you have in humans and in lower mammals, you have increased heart rate, increased sweating, increased blood pressure, decrease in appetite. You can have a startle response. You can have freezing. All these things show themselves down the evolutionary scale. But I think what might distinguish humans from animals is the cognitive component of it. So there's a lot of worry. There's a lot of rumination. These kinds of thought processes that contribute to the fear response seem to be a human specialty.
How much of fear is learned behavior? And by that I mean, as we get older, are we conditioned to know to be afraid of more things simply as a matter of our experience?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, an infant, there are very few things that can cause fear for an infant. A loud, sudden noise, bodily injury, Loss of support to the back of the head, so the head falls back, that could cause a baby fear. But other than that, there are very few things. And everything else that we fear, including guns and dark alleys and cyanide and all that, is all acquired by way of conditioning. It's all acquired by way of these what seem to be neutral stimuli, let's say fire to a baby. It's neutral until they touch it, and then it's painful. The baby will learn to fear fire at close ranges. So, yes, by and large, the things that we fear have been learned, have been conditioned. What also, of course, happens as you get older is you also learn what's safe, and so you're better at discriminating safety from danger. Now, so you do have a larger array of things that you're afraid of, but you also have a larger array or a more nuanced understanding of when you really are in danger and when you aren't.
We're talking with Dr. Shmuel Lissick. He is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Minnesota. He's an expert on the psychology and biology of fear. When someone has an anxiety disorder or post-traumatic stress disorder, what's going on in their bodies with that, and how is that different from just a basic fear of something?
Right. The way it's different primarily, and we can talk about the brain response, it's the persistence of a fear response in the absence of danger. So let's take, for example, a U.S. soldier in Iraq who is driving along the road and comes across a roadside object, and that roadside object detonates, and they become very afraid of roadside objects. While they're in Iraq, it's adaptive and normal to be afraid of roadside objects. Now, when they come home and they're in their safe pre-deployment environment, if the fear of roadside objects persists, which could lead them to avoid driving, which you could impair their personal and professional life in obvious ways, if that persists, that becomes post-traumatic stress disorder, because there is no real threat, and the emotion is sort of getting the best of them, and that's the key difference between an adaptive fear and a maladaptive fear associated with post-traumatic stress disorder or other anxiety disorders. It's essentially fear in the absence of any viable threat. So you might also say that let's say a child who's in an abusive home, if that child is chronically fearful, that's not PTSD per se, although they may get the diagnosis, but I would argue that it's not PTSD because they are responding to a real threat to their survival that's just ongoing. It would be PTSD if the child is removed from that home, placed or the threat is neutralized and the child continues to show that level of fear. That would be a post-traumatic response.
Now, is it fair to say, or a bit too simple to say, that fears are either rational or irrational?
Yes, I would say so. I mean, I think, in a very cut and dry way, they're irrational if there is no true danger, and they're rational if there is a true danger. So even if, for example, if December 21st did come with great catastrophe, which I don't believe it will, but if it did, then people who are fearing it now, in retrospect, we'd have to call it rational. So in a sense, it's all outcome-driven, whether it's rational or not. Another way of maybe looking at it, though, is you could define rational as whether or not a person brings to bear what's understood about the way the world works to their fear. Is it a child doesn't have a great understanding of the way the world works and is very susceptible to fearing things like monsters and other things like that. As you get older, you're less susceptible to that. You have more experience with the world, knowing that monsters are not a part of it. Your world becomes more predictable, more explainable, and rational. It may be a rational response to filter incoming threats through that understanding of the way the world works, which will filter out a lot of seemingly threatening things that really aren't.
When do we need to seek professional help for our fears or anxieties?
Primarily when you yourself feel that it's compromising the quality of your life, so that you're spending an undue amount of time being fearful, or if those around you believe that your fear is impairing your ability to function in your personal life or in your professional life. So it's really about functioning. It's really about how well the person is functioning externally in their personal and professional world, and also internally. How much discomfort are they experiencing as a result of the fear and anxiety? And if there is a feeling that it may be impacting their quality of life, they should err on the side of seeking assistance through mental health professionals.
When we booked this show a couple of weeks back, we were going to focus primarily on the so-called Mayan apocalypse on December 21st. But unfortunately, and quite tragically, another major incident happened this past Friday, the school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut.
Right.
Dr. Lissick, what advice would you give to parents and to children about dealing with fears as a result of the school shooting?
You know, I think that, it is... good. Everybody does respond in their own way, and it is good to not force discussions of the issue on kids. They may be best handling it without bringing it up as much. Maybe they should be. It should be brought up later. I think the key is that you want to, as an adult trying to discuss these issues, you want to be sensitive to the child. If the child, it seems like their upset is overwhelming, you want to stop that kind of conversation. You don't want to re-traumatize the child. You want to first be able to get them to a place where they're calm and they're not being re-traumatized, and then they could discuss it. But ultimately, and this is not something that adults would do now, but ultimately, the child will gain an understanding that this was an unusual event, that this is not evidence that their world is an extremely dangerous place where around every corner something bad will happen, because that's how they'll feel now. Around every corner there could be some looming danger. And as they get older and as they have more experience and they have a more adult view of the way the world works, most of them will be able to understand that this was a very, very, very unusual event that is not likely to ever happen again to them. And it's a very unfortunate event, obviously. It's a huge tragedy. But that the world as we know it is more or less safe.
We've been talking with Dr. Shmuel Lessig. He is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Minnesota. He's an expert on the psychology and biology of fear. Dr. Lessig, thank you so much for chatting with us on Access Minnesota.
Thank you.
Access Minnesota will return after these messages.
We are eggheads and brainiacs. We are learners and lab rats. We are stone-turning, Bunsen-burning, hyperactive hypothesizers, slam-dunking, hoota-thunkums, shouting Eureka out louder and louder and summa cum laude. Put another way, we're physio-socio-zoo, psycho-to-micro-musicological mathma-cryptologists with a whole lot in our melons. Check that. Our cerebellums. We are the University of Minnesota, and we are driven to discover.
Learn more at umn.edu.